Species.
Unite.
Species. Unite.
So the irony is that that meat that people are so obsessed about their cat needing, yeah, in the wild, the cat needs meat because in the wild, that meat is a source of the nutrients that cat needs. But on a commercial bag of pet food, those nutrients, those core key nutrients that the cat needs, they're not coming from the meat. They're coming from the premix that is largely a synthetic mix of vitamins and minerals that have been lost from the meat.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. On October 1st, Species Unite is starting our 30-day vegan challenge. So if you haven't signed up for it, sign up. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click 30-day vegan challenge. It's really good. It's 30 days of recipes, tips, information on all things plant-based. And if you're already vegan, sign up anyway because it's really good information. And if you have no interest in ever being vegan, just do it for 10 days, see what it's like. Go to our website, speciesunite.com/challenge. This conversation is with Shannon Falkner. Shannon is the CEO and co-founder of Because Animals, a pet food company that is making cultured meat for our cats and dogs. Their first cultured meat product will be on the market in 2022. It's mouse treats for cats. Yes, treats made with real mouse meat. Only there are no mice hurt in the process. Shannon, hi, thank you so much for being here and doing this today. It's really cool to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you very much, Beth, for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Before we start and get into Because Animals, will you just talk a little bit about how this becomes someone's life and career? Because you're kind of one of the only people on the planet doing what you're doing.
Yeah, sure. For me, it started, you know, I guess it started really, really young. Like I grew up with three dogs and three cats, and I developed a really close relationship with animals at a young age. There was just sort of, I guess I, from early childhood, I felt a bond, a connection with animals, non-two-legged animals that I don't feel quite as readily with humans, human animals. That drove me to stop eating meat at an early age, my early teens, and then I started volunteering at various shelters or rescue organizations in my late teens. And then that became a much bigger part of my life. I'm a scientist by training, did my master's in biochemistry and my PhD in chemical biology. And so that's what I would do during the day. You know, this is why I love science, but definitely in my weekends and evenings and sort of spare time would volunteer for animal rescue. And they were just sort of two separate parts of my life. And I knew that a career in the pharmaceutical industry would be just, there would just, animals were there. And it was just, yeah. I decided that I was on the wrong side of the line in terms of what I believed in. And I decided that I would work to dedicate my scientific training to taking animals out of the supply chain rather than helping to keep them in. And research animals, they're just, I didn't see a way for me to apply that training so easily or directly, but definitely with respect to food, there was a clearer path. And initially I thought, okay, yeah, for sure, work on creating a food that would serve as an alternative for humans, because of course humans are the main consumers of animal-based products. Then as I started to think about it more and like just reflect and okay, so I myself haven't eaten meat in decades, but I have lots of options. But when it comes to my pets, like there's virtually nothing and I am forced to support this industry that I otherwise would not. And then as I started to dig into it more and understand, so 50% of an animal is consumed by humans. The rest of that 50% is not. It goes to something called a rendering facility, which, you know, all this meat is sort of blended together. And that's largely applied to pet food. But in addition to that, the byproducts, also, there's a significant number of animals, sadly, that don't ever make it to slaughter because they die before getting there. So die during transit or dehydration or suffocation or disease. And so they're referred collectively in the industry as fallen animals. And these fallen animals, again, unless they're slaughtered expressly for consumption, they cannot be sold for the human food category. These carcasses are also sent to this rendering facility. So in the end, you have a massive amount of this flesh and carcasses and meat that is not usable for, it's unsellable for human food. And so the animal agriculture industry, though, rather than just disposing of it, and they couldn't just dispose of it, they'd have to actually pay to have it disposed of as biohazardous waste. And there's so much of it, actually, that in terms of numbers, if that were the case, within 4 years, all landfills in the U.S. would be full. So, but instead, they sell it to pet food. And so pet food is actually this phenomenal outlet that serves as a revenue generator, and it allows the animal agriculture industry to stay afloat in a way that it otherwise could not. Right. And nonetheless, this is a white space when it comes to, you know, what we as humans think about. For us who think about upending the system, we never think about pet food, but really it's sort of this silent partner that is so critical to the functioning of the system. And that's why we chose pet food.
So in 4 years, all the landfills would be full with what we feed our pets if we didn't use all the byproducts and the downed animals for pet food.
This comes straight from the horse's mouth, if you will. It's actually the National Renderers Association who provides these incredible statistics around numbers. Right. Their argument is that this is actually a very environmental practice, right? Because if we couldn't make use of all of these animals for pet food, then it just would not be environmentally sustainable. They're right. It would not be environmentally sustainable, nor would it be profitable for the animal agriculture industry. And the whole industry would basically collapse. See it from one side of the coin, I see it from another.
It's shocking, but it's not. I mean, animal agriculture, the whole system is so fragile. We just saw during COVID how easily the whole thing can collapse.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. It's a disaster.
Yes.
So even though it's mostly byproduct, pet food still has the same environmental implications as the factory farm meat that humans eat. And dogs and cats eat a lot of meat. What is it, like 25%?
Actually, yeah. So closer to 30%, a study has shown that, yeah, between 25 and 30% of the environmental effects of the animal agriculture industry in terms of deforestation, water, and fossil fuel use is directly attributed to the foods that Americans feed their cats and dogs. If we think about, you know, yes, cats and dogs are smaller than humans, but if we think about in terms of their caloric intake, they consume for their body mass, they consume more animal derived ingredients than the average human does. For all intents and purposes, I mean, there's a very niche market with vegan or vegetarian dog food. If you think about the vast majority of all cats and dogs are eating at every meal a very, very concentrated diet, a diet that's concentrated in animal products versus humans, that it's much less concentrated. I guess it depends on the human, but averaged.
It also makes you think, what are they actually eating, right? If it would be biohazardous waste.
The reason it is considered biohazardous waste is because they're not slaughtered, they're not actually processed at that moment, right? And so when an animal dies, the immune system dies too. And so now all of those microbes that were living on the animal are able to take over. And so basically it turns into sort of this rotting meat. So that's why it goes to the rendering facility, because at a rendering facility, all of these various body parts, so blood, viscera, bones, various organs, and then the decaying and the fallen animals is basically all kind of melted under high heat and pressure. The pathogens are killed because it's a very intense sterilization process. Interestingly, in the process of that intense sterilization, many of the nutrients that are naturally found in meat, they are also lost. And so that's why for cat and dog food, if any pet parent looks at the ingredient list, they'll see a really long list of closer to the bottom or halfway through of vitamins and minerals. And so all of these, many of these essential nutrients have to be added back to the food because the meat that contained it in the first place loses it, through the rendering process, and then they have to be added back. So it's kind of bizarre.
It's more than bizarre. So you see this need for a solution in the pet food industry, and no one else is doing this.
No. So other folks are working on alternative protein for cats and dogs. But of course, cultured meat is not an alternative protein. It is meat. It's just produced in an alternative way. So at the moment, Because Animals is still the only company making cultured meat for pet food.
That's so amazing. And your first product's about to come out.
The first cultured mouse product, or the first cultured meat product. And yeah, we chose mouse, cultured mouse for cats. The reason being that, you know, in the wild, cats eat mice, they eat small birds and insects. Most pet food includes chicken and beef and seafood. But as it turns out, those are also the main allergens for cats and dogs. They are only used as the main ingredients because, of course, they're left over from the human food supply chain. So in making cultured meat, yeah, we really saw this as an opportunity to use the protein source that is most evolutionarily appropriate for cats.
One thing it shows you is how conditioned we are as humans. When I first saw the cultured meat of mice for cats, my first reaction was like, oh, for a second. And then you're like, no, wait, cats eat mice.
Yeah.
But we're so conditioned. Oh, no, cats eat this.
Right.
Like stuff that, of course, they don't eat.
Right.
And dogs wouldn't eat cows.
No, they wouldn't. And I mean, a lot of people would say, dogs would. But actually, the tricky thing with dogs is that they've evolved, or they've diverged from their ancestor much more than cats have. The domestic dog is actually, as a species, it doesn't really exist in the wild. It's been domesticated. Dogs are not wolves now. They have evolved. They have a very different genetic makeup, metabolic makeup. Their nutritional needs are quite different than that of wolves. Nonetheless, they look similar to wolves. I mean, a chihuahua doesn't look similar to a wolf, but people still believe that all dogs are like wolves, and it's simply not the case. But for cats, it's a slightly different story. Cats definitely metabolically, they haven't evolved much. They still do need certain key nutrients that in the wild they can only consume from another animal. The trick thing, of course, though, with pet food, as I mentioned, with cat food, because it goes to this rendering facility, so a lot of those core nutrients like taurine are lost. And so this is why you always see on every cat food package, taurine has to be added back. And that taurine doesn't come from an animal. It comes from, like, it's a synthetic source of taurine. So the irony is that meat that people are so obsessed about their cat needing, yeah, in the wild, the cat needs meat because in the wild, that meat is a source of the nutrients that cat needs. But on a commercial bag of pet food, those nutrients, those core key meat nutrients that the cat needs, they're not coming from the meat. They're coming from the premix that is largely a synthetic mix of vitamins and minerals that have been lost from the meat.
Again, it's just so crazy how our food system is backwards and kind of, you know, none of it really makes sense, even our pet food system. But cats need taurine. So for the mice, first you're starting with the mouse treats. Talk about how, like, this whole process, because it's changed a little bit in the sense of how you actually get from mouse to treat. Will you just kind of take us through the process?
Yeah, for sure. So basically, we are growing real mouse tissue. So what we did was we started with cells that did originally come from mice. And so for us, we took some cells from, so there were actually three mice, and we took some cells from their ears. And those mice actually have since then, they've gone to live with one of our stem cell scientists, and they're almost two now, so they're geriatric by mouse standards. But so those cells, though, they can be used as a starting point for growing all of the cells that we need moving forward. From those cells, we isolate certain types of cells from the sort of matrix of different cells. And then from there, we can actually start to grow out those cells and choose which cells we want to continue growing. And I say cells eventually, whether or not you're growing stem cells, or you're growing muscle cells, or you're growing fat cells. And we grow these cells now in a bioreactor. A bioreactor being actually a tool that is widely used in the food industry. A bioreactor is simply basically a vessel that allows for gas exchange and temperature control. And it's where any probiotics, so in terms of foods that people eat right now, probiotics would be grown in a bioreactor. Yeast for beer is grown in a bioreactor. So we're using the same thing. It's not actually this novel technology. The only real difference is that rather than growing these classical or traditional microbial cells in the bioreactor, we're now growing a mammalian cell. And then once the input is with these cells, we feed them vitamins and minerals, the cells are consuming them, and we're growing more and more biomass, more and more cells. And then in the end, we collect those cells and then we blend them with, say, for example, for our mouse treat, we blend those cells with other ingredients that are in the mouse treat and bake it. And it basically just serves as it's just like a cat treat, except that a normal cat treat that would have some meat in there, would have some other ingredients in there. We're using cultured meat instead of animal raised meat.
What else is in the treat?
We've included, there's pumpkin in there. We've used some other cultured ingredients. So miso is in there, some tempeh in there, nutritional yeast. These are all tasty things and healthy things.
And why start with a treat? Is it like a scaling thing? Because it's only requires so much?
Yeah, exactly. So because animals like every other company, scaling is a challenge. And so certainly in order to get our product out, we will have to do so in sort of very, very smaller batches than we would like out the gate. And so, a treat allows us to do that. Of course, we will launch a nutritionally complete food as well. But once we have a food out, then that cultured meat needs to be at the front of the ingredient panel, needs to be the main ingredient. With treats, they're in between, you know, it's an in-between meal snack. Meat doesn't need to be the main ingredient. So it's a little lower in the ingredient list.
So that'll kind of be the trajectory. Start with the treats, maybe do dog treats, and then go into food, actual food.
That's right. Yeah. So from the cat treats, so the cultured mouse for cats, and we will, after our Series A fundraise, our next species of will be a rabbit cell line for dog food. So we're really focused on this sort of small native prey. And then once the treats, as we continue to scale, then we will eventually be able to gravitate towards a new complete food.
I can't imagine any consumers not wanting this for their pets. Like, it's so much healthier. It's so much less cruel. It's like the perfect solution. I don't know what kind of feed, like what people are saying, but I would imagine, like, I can't imagine who wouldn't want this for their pet. It just feels like the smartest solution out there.
Well, I think so. I think so too. I would agree with you. But of course, we do get feedback from people saying that, you know, this isn't something that they would want to participate in or feed their pets. And I, by and large, based on the comments that we get, my strong feeling is that this is just, it's based on people really not knowing what it is. And that's totally cool, because why would they know? This product doesn't exist. And so it's based on a lot of misinformation for people who somehow think it's, they refer to it as synthetic meat or fake meat. It's without actually thinking or understanding that actually these are animal cells. They're just, again, the cells are grown without having the entire intact animal. And the other thing that people tend not to think about too is they'll sort of say, oh yeah, the animal, that's the natural way. Well, I mean, there are a lot of things around, you know, animal husbandry that, I mean, what is natural to begin with anyway? But when an animal is slaughtered, it's a very unclean process, right? And so this is why there are recalls of meat, because actually, I think there's been third-party testing of meat, just from not pet food, just meat in general, confirming that 100% of meat, when allowed to just sit at 37 degrees, there are fecal contaminating bacteria on that meat. And why wouldn't there be, right? So you think about these animals, these farmed animals, they are raised in it's a quagmire of shit, frankly, right? And then they're slaughtered. I mean, it's impossible to extricate the animal from this microbial contamination. However, when we grow these cells in a bioreactor, there is no immune system from the animal. So if there is any contamination, microbial contamination, we see it immediately. Like it jumps right out at us, and then we would kill the culture. Like that's it. That culture's done, and we start again. So it's a very, very clean and controlled process. We know all of the inputs. And when I say inputs, we don't use any antibiotics when we grow our meat or growth-promoting steroids. These are very, very, very typically used in animal husbandry, especially antibiotics. In fact, 80% of the antibiotics manufactured in the US are sold to animal agriculture. So animal agriculture, put that way, I mean, it poses a major threat to public health. Every pandemic that we've seen in history has come from, it's a virus that has come from an animal. So typically, viruses do not cross species barrier. But when they do, they are very, very virulent, very, very pathogenic. And animal agriculture, small spaces, animals can find stressful conditions where greater situations of stress, there's more excrement, there's more shedding of virus and bacteria. These are areas that are rife with contamination. So they pose as, you know, it's a human public health threat. And then, of course, yeah, the environmental consequences of, and the humane aspect of animal agriculture. There's no good reason to actually not completely embrace cultured meat, especially for pets. When we think about humans, okay, humans are omnivores. We don't actually need meat, especially for pets. Cultured meat is really the ideal option.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's coming. That's the best part.
Yeah.
What about regulations? Like, is it different? I would imagine the human regulations are a lot harder to get, you know, to go through than the pet food industry. But how does that work? Are you allowed, if you had it right now, could you sell it now? Or do you have to wait on regulations?
So we cannot sell it in the US. So every place in the world is different in terms of how human food or pet food is regulated. The differences between those two regulatory paths are also different depending on the region. So actually in the US, surprisingly, maybe for some, it's not actually easier to approve a pet food product, a new pet food ingredient, than it is necessarily for a human food ingredient in the US, which is surprising, understanding where most meat for pet food comes from. It's a very, very bizarre sort of setup or industry that sort of regulates pet food in the US. And ultimately, the FDA regulates pet food, but they rely heavily on this organization called AFCO, or Association of American Feed Control Officials, which is sort of this conglomerate of different stakeholders, the FDA being one of them. But it's also various, well, frankly, like lobbying organizations and heavy in the meat industry. And so it's difficult to see them as a totally neutral third-party entity.
Do they make getting regulated hard on purpose? For something like what you're doing, right? Do you know when you'll be in the clear and you can sell here in the US? Or do you still have a lot of hurdles to go through?
Yeah, I don't know when we'll be able to. And I will say thus far, any communication that I've had with the FDA, it's all been very positive. It hasn't been, I haven't felt as though there have been like unnecessary barriers or something like that. Definitely, it's been heartwarming to experience that there's, you know, the folks that I've communicated with have been very interested and eager and keen to communicate. So that's good. Yeah, so that's great. But different regions, different places in the world, yeah, different paths. So when we first launch, it won't be in the US because we won't have had the regulatory approval to sell there yet. But different parts in the world are different. And so we will, our first launch will be in another country, which we'll announce in December when we launch. But the plan absolutely is to sell in the US eventually.
Awesome. The whole world needs it, but we really need it.
No. Yeah, which is why we are focused on the US. So frankly, we are a company that's dedicated, you know, our mission is to take animals out of the supply chain. And so looking at the greatest offenders, just in terms of the amount of, not only the amount of meat consumed, but also the treatment of animals just in large commercial scale animal agriculture. I mean, some of the worst offenders, the US, China. I mean, these are at the top.
It's brutal. And what about costs? Will this cost a lot more than, say, regular cat treats or cat food?
It will cost us more in terms of our margins, certainly, to produce it than it will for another company. But the cost to the consumer won't be much more or any more. So, you know, for us, absolutely, in order to take animals out of the supply chain, that means we need to be price competitive with other products. So definitely we will be priced accordingly at the outset, which is the way our current products are priced. So we are priced in the premium, ultra premium category. But that's also the only actively growing segment of pet food. So the sort of economical or low or budget priced pet food is there are fewer and fewer people buying those products. So generally speaking, you know, people, a lot of people really want to do well by their pets. And so they want to be purchasing foods that they, that are more nutritious, or they come from animals that have been treated humanely or whatever. So the price point is higher, and folks are willing to pay for that.
I know it's astronomically expensive to do what you're doing right now in terms of just the amount of research, the amount of, it's never been done, you know, it sells at a lab, it's all of that. But at some point, won't it become much less expensive to produce?
Yes, it definitely. And I think you mean less expensive than like traditional meat, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's sort of the beauty of science and continuing to sort of iterate. And we will continue to work on bringing down the cost. When you think about animal agriculture, I mean, really the amount of, we're dealing with, okay, the amount of land that has to be, say, cleared to not only raise all of the animals, but also to grow the grain to then feed the animals, the amount of water that needs to be used to actually grow the crops to then feed the animals. There's a certain point where, yeah, it doesn't become any cheaper at all. It cannot become any cheaper to produce animal meat. And animal meat is also very heavily subsidized by the government. So when you look at the price that you're paying in the grocery store for meat, that is not how much it costs to produce that cut of meat from an animal. The great thing about what we're doing with cultured meat is, yeah, we do have this, we just started, I mean, as an industry, we've just started. And so, you know, we have a long ways to go, but there is a long way to go in terms of, there's a lot of potential in terms of what we can achieve.
Right. No, it's going to get better every year. So we're not that far away.
No, let's be optimistic. Yeah, try to be.
How do people get your treats?
The easiest place to buy our products is from our website, becauseanimals.com. And even there, people can sign up our pre-order list. We are taking pre-orders for our cultured mouse treats as well. So Ooh. People can pre-order from our website too, but they can also just purchase directly our supplement and our treats. We're also available on Amazon and Chewy.
It's awesome. I'm pre-ordering. I don't even have a cat, but I'm going to order it and give it away.
Great. Okay. Awesome.
Shanna, thank you so much. I'm so excited about this. And I'm so glad that you guys are in the world, seriously, and doing this, because we need it.
Thanks so much, Beth.
To learn more about Shannon, to learn about Because Animals, and to pre-order Harmless Hunt mouse treats for cats, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And if you have a spare minute and could do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people find the show. If you'd like to support the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. Become a member of Species Unite. Go to our website and click Become a Member. I'd like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knutson, Natalie Martin, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.